Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Not Just New Movies podcast, the show where we review a seemingly random film currently not in theaters. My name is Ben Pearson, and today we're going to be talking about Quentin Tarantino's 1994 film Pulp Fiction. Joining me today is my regular co-host, Tyler. How's it going, sir?
Hey, Ben, I got a new tagline for the podcast.
Let's hear it.
We almost got Kevin Smith once.
I like that. I like that. Yeah. We'll use it until maybe one day we actually...
Yeah, and then we'll change it to, we had Kevin Smith on once.
I like it. Joining us today is a very special guest. He is a writer and comedian who co-wrote and co-starred in the 2009 film Mystery Team and has appeared in countless sketches as a member of Derek Comedy. DC Pearson, thanks so much for joining us on the Not Just New Movies podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. What have you been up to lately, DC? Anything worth talking about? You've been busy or taking some time off or what's going on?
Let's see. Taking some time off. God forbid. That'd be amazing. who does that? Who would you talk to that would be like, yeah, just, I don't know. I just went to the south of France and like bummed around.
Right here.
I wrote a book that came out last year that I would love to plug.
Yes. Yeah. I own this book. It's called The Boy Who Couldn't Sleep and Never Had To. Really solid. Why don't you tell people just like what it's about?
It's basically a sort of, it's a novel. It's a coming of age thing that turns into kind of more of a science fiction, adventure. And it's basically about these two best friends in high school that are nerds, and they're kind of too nerdy for any of the actual like nerd cliques that exist, like the band kids or the theater kids or whatever. They're just kind of in their own world, and they're working on this like comic book series that they want to turn into a series of novels that they want to turn into like a massively multiplayer online video game. And like basically the way you just get like way over ambitious with stuff when you have no like, you know, you're in like high school and you have no means to actually make anything happen. You can just, everything can just be as big as you want it to be. Mm-hmm. And then one of the friends reveals to the other friend that he has no biological need for sleep and he never has. And it actually turns out that this is the case. And so that's sort of the beginning, this like secret that they have to keep. And that's kind of the beginning of their adventure. And then it turns out that like lots of other stuff is true as well. And you gotta read it and find out what that is.
Yes.
Dun, dun, dun.
Cloverfield Monster.
Yeah, it's all Cloverfield Monsters. They find out that their little suburb is being run by a council of Cloverfield Monsters.
How do they stay undercover?
You must pull out like the Super 8 monsters, and they're like, ah, shut up.
Get back to work,
they say.
Oh, amazing. But yeah, no, in all seriousness, this is a really great book, and I think if people are listening to this podcast in particular and have enjoyed Tyler and I's banter back and forth about like random science fiction things and stuff, this is definitely a book that you guys will enjoy.
It's been described as Outland meets Zardoz.
No way, we just watched those two movies.
Interesting, yeah, exactly. Ooh. Sean Connery, imagine Sean Connery's voicing every character.
Oh, it's like, funny, because Sean Connery was the one who described it as Outland meets Zardoz.
Yeah, it's like Outland meets Zardoz. That is
such a supplemental work to this podcast.
Totally.
Amazing. All right, well, if you guys are just listening in for the very first time, we start every episode with a character name game, transition into our media consume section where we talk about what we've been watching, move into our big review of the week, and finish up with listener voicemails and emails. You guys can always leave us a voicemail at 904-469-6566 or email us at notjustnewmovies@gmail.com. And you can find this and every other episode of this podcast at notjustnewmovies.com. So,
hey,
guys, I've got the character name game for this week. Tyler, did I just cut you off? You were saying something?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think we might have a pretty awesome voicemail at the end of this. So everybody listen to the very end.
Okay. Is it almost from Kevin Smith?
We'll see.
We'll have to wait and find out.
It's a voicemail from Kevin Smith's assistant.
I'm sorry, he won't be able to make it to your podcast today. Just a heads up.
I listened to this voicemail right before we recorded, so yeah, it's probably worth sticking around for in case you guys were thinking about bailing out.
So what you're saying is you're rock hard right now.
Exactly. It's my turn for the character name game this week. I'll give you guys a character name, and at the very end of the show, you have to come back and try to guess what movie that character is from, keeping in mind that there has to be some sort of connection to a movie that came out in wide release this past weekend. So the character name for this week is Frank D'Amico. So just be simmering on that, and we'll come back to it at the very end. But in the meantime, let's move on into the media consumed section. This is the part of the show where we talk about what we've been watching, TV, movies, any sort of, I don't know, cool events that we've attended or anything like that. Tyler, let's start with you. What have you been consuming this week?
Well, just this morning I watched True Grit from 2010 as opposed to the 1969 version starring John Wayne.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen this, Ben? Have you seen this, DC?
I have seen it, yes.
Okay, yeah, I'm a little late to the party, about 7 months behind schedule. But pretty good film. Was this nominated for any awards? I think so.
It was up for Best Picture, yes.
Okay.
You said that and I'm like, okay, don't hassle me. All right, get into it.
I think it was, in the year of 2010, I think it was worth a Best Picture nod. And it was a great Western, although a lot of people said it wasn't going to be a remake of the original film, that it was going to be more of the Portis novel.
Mm-hmm.
And although it probably was, it was very similar to the 1969 version. And I'll tell you why. Because, like, almost scenes, I knew which scenes were coming next. And they did come, and, like, the same, like, the courthouse scene at the beginning and the, you know, the trip across the country with the Texican. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that I really found different was the ending.
Yep.
You know, the 1969 version ends, I guess, differently. But Jeff Bridges' Rooster Cogburn was near incoherent for most of the time, although I guess that was one of the more comical parts of the movie. But like, even the acting of Ned Pepper and Tom Chaney, the guys that played those characters, the guys that killed the dad and ran the gang. Mm-hmm. Like, I could almost hear and see Robert Duvall and Chaney's character. And Josh Brolin, I guess, played Ned Pepper.
Ned Pepper.
Do I have him mixed up?
Yeah.
Ned Pepper's the guy with the thing on his face and the beard, I believe.
Yeah.
Tom Chaney was the leader of the gang, which Tom Chaney was played by Robert Duvall back in the original True Grit. And I could almost see, like, Duvall, and I could see the other character that played Ned Pepper in Josh Brolin's performance. So a lot of similarities, but again, you know, I kept wishing they would have taken the production quality of this film and made another Western, like a new story or something we haven't seen before or heard of, which I think would have been, you know, it may not have gotten as much prestige as True Grit did, but I think I would have liked to see that, because True Grit is so holy and, you know, pristine in my vision, because it is a John Wayne movie and I was raised on John Wayne movies, and I don't like films kind of taken away from the John Wayne legacy in any way. But having said that, I do think it was a good film, and I think people should check it out, especially if you're a fan of the True Grit original.
Yes. DC, what did you think about True Grit?
Oh, I had a last point.
Oh, go ahead.
The Satfield, what was the girl's name?
Haley Steinfeld.
She did a much better job than the original.
Kim Darby.
Did not like her performance in the original True Grit. Very annoying.
Yeah.
I thought it was originally played by Annette Funicello, right? No? She was wearing mouse ears?
Drew Barrymore.
Yeah, that's it. There you go. Yes, I did see True Grit. I've seen the original movie, like, but forever ago when I was a kid. And I am a huge fan of the original book. I think it's like, I don't know, it's just super funny and kind of smart and you know, just really, really super well written. So what I did like about this one, as opposed to, and again, I haven't seen it in a really long time, so more my memory of the original is the kind of, like, I guess, capturing of that girl's point of view, I think largely through her having it's just an all around better performance and she's just a super smart, brassy kid who isn't gonna kind of take shit, and there's nothing cute about her, which I really liked.
Mm-hmm.
And also the original book is way close to my heart because my mom actually arc read it to me when I was a kid, like once you start getting into like chapter books and stuff, but like when I was still real young, like probably 9 or 10. So I don't know, I'm super fond of the Coen brothers, super fond of the whole thing. I do need to watch it again, but I kind of feel like the Jeff Bridges unintelligibility thing, like that's part of the charm, I feel like. You know, it's just the sort of thing where it's one of those movies where there's a character that's unintelligible. And I would imagine as you go back and watch it, part of the fun is like getting more and more of what he says and getting into his sort of like Cogburn speak per se.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, Tyler, I mean, I agree that it really is almost like a scene for scene recreation of that movie, but I think there's enough differences in the 2010 version that it almost does make it kind of an entirely separate like entity, because the Coen brothers just add so much of that dialogue and stuff that they're kind of known for. And yeah, like DC said, a lot of that does come from the novel, which I haven't read, but like the original source material or whatever. But I think it's different enough where you can like one and not the other. But it's one of the weirder adaptations, now that I think about it, where it's like, it's kind of divisive. Like, a lot of people did like it, but a lot of people were like, ah, this is not nearly the John Wayne movie. But it's really strange when, you know, you see a filmmaking team as whatever, popular, dominant, if you will, as the Coen brothers, taking on material like that instead of doing an original project or whatever. It's clear that they had something to say with it. They wanted to add their own flair to this story, especially after they just recently did kind of a modern day Western with No Country for Old Men. So it's like,
which is really good.
Yeah, they've obviously got some sort
of. But again, also an adaptation.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, of the Cormac McCarthy novel. So yeah, I mean, they've obviously got a passion for True Grit in particular, and they really had something that they specifically wanted to do with it. And I mean, it's clear to me that they succeeded in doing that.
I just can't wait to remake The Empire Strikes Back someday, like 30 years from now.
Do you think that's going to happen, Tyler? Do you legitimately?
Yes, I think so. I think until George Lucas dies, I think he's going to be using the same movies over and over again in some capacity.
Yeah. I think
once he dies, I think we'll be able to make sequels and sequels without having to resort to 3D.
Yeah, 3D re-releases.
Stuff
yeah.
like that, yeah.
Interesting.
I got retweeted by the official Star Wars account this week. I was very excited.
Oh, cool.
You know, where that is a feather in my Star Wars cap. For
Can you share what you said?
I can. Well, I tweeted something that was very... I hate to be the guy who's repeating his tweets in a
speaking
forum. Yeah, exactly. But I had tweeted, it was a joke, which was, I'm still so mad at George Lopez about the prequels. which I was real, real proud of. And I tweeted it, and it wasn't getting a lot of traction. And then my friend Donald retweeted it, and he's got tons of followers. So it kind of blew up after that. And then a couple days later, I was like, oh, it's getting like even more. I'm getting weirdly a lot of followers, like for some reason. But then a lot of people were responding to it in this very Looney Tunes kind of way. Like people that don't follow me and were just for random people being like, really not getting the joke. Like really being like, he didn't make it. George Lucas, you're an idiot. Like people responding in like these like five tweet sort of tirades about like how wrong I was.
140 just, characters is not enough to tell you how wrong.
No, exactly. And then there was this weird one that I got of basically this guy who doesn't have like a picture, like doesn't have a profile picture. It's just like the default like Twitter picture.
Right. Like, the egg.
This was either a spam bot or 80 years old or whatever.
One of the two.
Or both. And they're an 80-year-old spam bot. It's been around since spam bots were steam-powered, and they came
beep,
in
boop, boop, beep.
Yeah, exactly. this guy responded to me, and that's like 8-tweet. Weird, not even tirade, because he wasn't mad at me, but he was like, yeah, I agree with you that the prequels weren't very good. But then in a sequence of like 9 tweets, he proceeded to describe to me like what he thinks like episodes 7, 8, and 9 should be. It was delightfully crazy and just a total... scattershot capitalization and really everything you want from a crazy 8-tweet missive like that.
Yes,
sounds brilliant. Like you have a new partner on your hands.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I said. Let me fly out to
Get
Hollywood.
The idea, man.
Let's make this happen. Yeah, exactly. It's the power behind the throne.
Amazing, amazing. Anything else you've been checking out recently, Tyler?
No, that's it.
Okay. DC, what have you been consuming this week?
I am deeply obsessed with the show Game of Thrones. Which do you guys watch it at all?
I have not seen it. I'm one of those people that does not have HBO, and I want to watch it. I'll probably see it as soon as it hits DVD or something, because I've been hearing nothing but good things.
I'm going to illegally watch it sometime soon.
Oh, well, don't do that.
I'm just kidding, of course.
Yeah, okay. Taking money right out of Sean Bean's kids' mouths. The beans. How's Sean Bean going to buy his kids beans? Because that's what they eat. Because that's what their name is.
That guy took arrows for those kids.
Yeah, exactly. But it is, I mean, everything you've probably heard about it is true. I don't want to be, like, going on about it. But, you know, it's just, like, I was really looking forward to it. But because I was so sort of, I think as a lot of people were kind of burned by my Lost fandom, I'm still essentially like this guy who's still trying to get over like a relationship that ended really poorly that was like a great relationship, but like, so I'm essentially like Jon Favreau in Swingers with his like New York girlfriend that he yep. still pines after. And that for me is Lost.
Okay.
So you just see pictures of, I'm just like in my apartment under a blanket eating orange, you know, drinking orange juice and like looking at old pictures of like me and like a Lost season
yeah.
5
and scrawling the numbers on the wall.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm still trying to get over that, and so I was very kind of reluctant to really get deeply involved in like a very sweeping like mythology sort of show again. And I watched the pilot of Game of Thrones, didn't love it actually. I was kind of like, oh no, do I not like this? And then the second episode, by the end of it, it all kind of like snapped into focus, and I was just totally obsessed. And yeah, it's just super well acted. They basically plant these things that like I think lesser shows maybe would like plant and then really not pay off until like 3 seasons down the road. But in this show, it's kind of like something gets planted and then it like immediately pays off, and they just pull the trigger and it's constantly moving super fast. And it's just super well acted and very well written and funny, and I don't know, it's great. I would say the only strike against it is there is a certain amount of like, oh, it's HBO, look how many titties there are. But then on the other hand, it's like, oh, sometimes it's nice to see, you know, boobs running around. I don't know, you know, that is the only thing where I'm like, I almost makes me feel like a grandpa where I'm like, do we need somebody going down on somebody in every scene? But I guess the answer is yes. I've also been reading the first book, and I'm about like, I would say maybe 3 episodes behind the series in the book, and the book is very enjoyable. And if you read the books while you're watching the show, it allows you to be a total know-it-all to whoever you're watching the show with. And be like, oh, well, you know, the symbol of that house is actually, and it's great. If you enjoy being a know-it-all, as I always have, I can't recommend that particular experience highly enough.
Okay, so I've got a question. You haven't finished the first book yet, is that right?
No.
Okay, so maybe you can't answer this, but I'm just wondering if
answer it.
You said that the reason
you've actually read the books illegally. You have gone into Barnes and Noble and gone to the bathroom.
How do you know? How do you recording them with my iPhone?
No,
recording the pages.
The monsters have been watching you.
Okay.
Well,
Ben, your question, sir.
I'm sorry. I'm just picturing like a Super 8 creature as the manager of a Barnes & Noble now.
Yeah, it's just hanging up there above the stall while I read.
Yeah, he basically
very
looks
disturbing.
Like Gremlin in Gremlins 2, where that one Gremlin like wears like a wig and is like dancing, but he's just like a middle manager type and like a white button down and a little tie, exactly. Like a tie clip.
Oh, amazing. All right.
Paint that picture.
Someone on the internet, some fan. Do it up.
So the question is, DC, you were talking about how it like plants these seeds and then kind of immediately pays them off. I'm wondering if that's because it's really expensive to produce the show, and when they were maybe potentially, and this is all just me theorizing, when they were making it, they weren't sure how popular it was going to be. So it's kind of like a situation that I would kind of imagine how Community works, the NBC show that DC you've actually appeared on before, where Dan Harmon, the creator of that show, has talked about how like he really wasn't sure if they were going to get renewed, so he kind of threw all of his like good stuff into the end of season one with like the Chicken Fingers episode and like the paintball episode and stuff. I'm wondering if there was something similar along the lines of Game of Thrones, or do you think because there is kind of a like a built-in audience already, do you think that they knew that they were going to be as successful?
I do think that in terms of like just good storytelling, like everything, you always want to be moving things up and like having things occur, you know, really close together. And hopefully you're like, there are some things that get planted that don't pay off until later. But then also there's like, if you're going to set something up, like, you know, if you're really good, I feel like you can then pay it off. And that leads to the next equally compelling thing just as quickly, hopefully.
Yeah.
As opposed to just having to draw things out forever. I think that as far as I can tell so far, from what I understand, like the series tracks the events of the book pretty closely. Mm-hmm. And the books, so like, I believe this first season is the entire first novel, which is also called Game of Thrones. And there are things in the book so far. Again, I haven't finished the book, and also the season finale is tomorrow night, so we'll find out. Or maybe it's tonight. Is today Sunday,
tonight.
You guys? It is.
It's
it is
tonight.
Sunday, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's exciting. But
You're on Australian
so
time.
you, I believe that, and also like the author George R. R. Martin is very involved in the making of the show, and he wrote actually a couple episodes ago. And he wrote the actual episode itself.
Oh, cool.
But I believe that it's pretty faithful, and there are some things that take a little longer to happen in the book. There's a little more kind of hemming and hawing and discussion, and things play out a little bit slower. But it just by the, and so by the nature of TV, I think you just obviously have to kind of keep things moving, and you can't have, you know, a lot of a third person omniscient narrator kind of filling things in for you.
Mm-hmm.
Everything has to be in dialogue. But it seems like they're just tracking the events of the actual book, you know, pretty much. So I think that's just a function of the source material.
Cool. Cool, cool. Yeah, I'm definitely... Go ahead, Tyler.
So the phrase "blew their load" isn't necessary?
Well, I think it's more like imagine that they're blowing their load, but then there's an even more exciting load further up the shaft.
Excellent.
And this is the kind of stuff that's going to get Kevin Smith on your guys' podcast.
These are scientific terms, of course.
These are scientific, yeah, exactly.
Ladies and gentlemen, we implore you.
Awesome. All right, anything else you've been consuming, DC?
I'm trying to think. What's that?
Up the Shaft.
I've been watching Up the Shaft, which is the story of the making of Shaft. It's more, I guess, maybe Down the Shaft. I don't know. It depends. It depends on how it hooks. But I've been watching, I just finished watching last night. I watched this movie, Marine Killer Instinct, which is the first part of a duology, I guess it would be called, because that's what it's called in the Netflix description. That's a two-part movie, I guess, about famous French gangster, Jacques Marine, played by Vincent Cassel, who is fucking awesome.
Yeah.
I honestly can't tell how good of a movie it is. I think that there's, you know, when you get stuff that's like foreign, and so it has, if you're like me, a certain air of foreignness to it, where you're a little concerned to question it, because you're like, oh, maybe it's not trash. Maybe it's super good and clever. Like, but with this thing, it's like a very compelling character and compelling events, but you're like, oh, I don't think this is like the French Goodfellas. It might not be that great, but you're like, I don't know anything about this guy, and I don't know what the story is, so I do find myself very compelled through it. And also, guy's got a great mustache, and there's lots of cute French girls in it holding guns.
Bonsoir.
So, yeah, exactly.
Nice. Yeah, I've heard really good things about that, and especially about Cassell's performance, who, yeah, is just kind of across the board a really, really interesting actor, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah, he's just totally magnetic to watch, and he's very enjoyable in this as well.
Cool. Good stuff. All right. So the one thing that I wanted to talk about, I've been going through this Superman, the motion picture anthology Blu-ray box set, and I'm almost done with it. I've got like 2 more hours of bonus features out of the 20 to watch, and then I can do a little write-up on it. But I just recently watched Superman Returns, and this is the first time I've seen this movie since it came out in theaters back in 2006.
Really?
And I kind of wanted to get your, both of you, like your thoughts about Superman Returns, just in very broad terms. Tyler, what are your thoughts on Superman Returns?
Ooh, me first. Okay. We actually saw this in IMAX. Remember, Ben?
I 2006? Do, yeah.
Mm-hmm. We didn't have jobs.
Yep.
Or much importance in the world. I don't think I really got into, like, of course I knew about Superman and the mythos, but I didn't really start getting into Superman until around this time. So when I went and saw the movie, I was like, oh, this blew me away. Of course, probably because it was in IMAX, but I really liked the, almost the religious, you know, everybody has talked about it already, but like kind of the religious and almost like sacred look at Superman as opposed to, you know, an action movie that everybody, you know, the other side of the argument wanted, where, you know, oh, he didn't throw a punch the entire movie, which is true.
Yep.
But I really enjoyed it. I went and bought it on DVD. I'm not ashamed.
Okay. All right.
I like
DC.
Kevin Spacey is Lex Luthor and Kate Bosworth as Lois Lane. So I'll say that as well.
Okay. All right. DC.
I haven't seen it since it came out, but I did. I remember being real excited for it. Because it's got a pretty good pedigree, right? Like Bryan Singer.
Yep.
And he who wrote the script?
Michael Dougherty and Dan Harris. Michael Dougherty went on to write and direct a movie called Trick or Treat, which we actually talked about on this podcast before.
Episode 92.
And I think Bryan Singer also like contributed stuff to the story as well. But.
Yeah, I do think I think it was a very kind of like loving homage to Superman and also to like the original movie. But I guess if I think back on it, I did leave a little disappointed in it. And I think that part of the thing is that I think that he was trying to juggle a lot of really delicate stuff without being ironic whatsoever, which I respect. Mm-hmm. Like it's an attempt at that movie that I can respect, but I don't know how much I love it just because I feel like he was just trying to do a lot of stuff that was very sincere and very unironic and very kind of like, yeah, like you said, almost this like religious, like sacred look at the Superman thing. But that's a lot of stuff that's like real, real delicate, like elements like that, like being that just kind of, you know, not really wanting to get your hands dirty with it. And, but I respect that they didn't try to make it this like gritty take on Superman, but yeah. Then also I feel like, to go in the other direction, there was stuff that just couldn't help but feel corny because of how kind of blown out 1930s serial they kind of played things. Like, you know, I specifically remember the feeling like the Kevin Spacey stuff and the supervillainy stuff was very much like that, where while they weren't doing a gritty, you know, or ironic or anything take on the character, there also wasn't a whole lot of like, there wasn't a whole lot of stuff that was kind of taking that thing's place. So it just felt kind of bloodless to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, that said, you know, it's like I said, it's a movie I respect. It clearly was very beautiful. And it also, I really enjoyed Brandon Routh. Ruth?
Yep, Routh, I think.
Routh. Everything he's gone on to do. I think he kind of like disappeared off the face of the planet for like a minute. And then, although I'm sure it didn't feel that way to him, I feel like that would probably be very annoying to hear anyone say that. You're like, I was out there, man. I was trying to do it. But like, he's obviously hilarious in Scott Pilgrim. And he's just a guy who I really like. Watching now, so that's a pretty cool thing to like burst onto the scene with.
And
I'm very much looking forward to the kind of Christopher Nolan godfathered new take on Superman, whatever mm-hmm. that's gonna be.
Yeah, I think that movie is going to be like the complete antithesis of Superman Returns, just by the very you know, act of Zack Snyder being the director. Like, I don't think, you know, as reverent as Snyder was with Watchmen, I just don't think he has it in him to make a movie like Superman Returns, in that it is so spiritual and all that kind of stuff, where it's like, you know, the entire movie is kind of painted with this haze that is very, very reminiscent of Donner's first film. And like, that's the thing that, you know, because I've watched all these Superman movies in a row over the course of the last few weeks, and
Quest for Peace.
And yeah, Quest for Peace is so bad, by the way.
Ben Pearson, A Quest for Peace. That's the name of your Superman.
But the thing that stuck out to me more this time, because I've had such a like an intense relationship with the Superman series over the past couple weeks, is how much Superman Returns really is almost a remake of Superman the movie. Like, Lex is there and he's over the top and very ridiculous, which I liked when I saw this movie in theaters, and I like Kevin Spacey still. I like that performance. But here, it's like his whole thing is land and, you know, creating land out of these crystal shards from the Fortress of Solitude. And that's like just essentially an updated, like, modernization of Gene Hackman's Lex Luthor trying to set off the San Andreas fault. And what's that?
He wanted to nuke the country apart, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah. He just wanted to set
California into the ocean.
Yeah, exactly. Set off the San Andreas Fault, spread California out into the ocean, and then just sell all the newly beachfront property and make a bunch of money off of it. And that's the same kind of story that Kevin Spacey is looking to do. But like, the movie just, you know, it seems good in concept, trying to, you know, take all these different elements from the first movie and kind of modernize it, you know, for a more contemporary audience. But a lot of it just doesn't really make a lot of sense. Like, when you see what the land mass looks like, which is just this hulking crag of, you know, shards and rocks and, like, sharp angles and stuff that comes out of the ocean at one point, you're just like, how is anyone planning on domesticating this land and living off of it? Like, what is Lex Luthor's end game here? And then the way that the movie kind of wraps up with him and the woman who I believe her name is Kitty, and it was played by Parker Posey, who, you know, when I saw this originally, did not realize she's essentially just like a cipher for, or like a copy of Miss Tessmacher from the original Donner movies, just kind of sidekick who's there just because. At the Superman Returns, the way it ends up is like Lex Luthor and Kitty are just stranded on this island where they've magically landed a helicopter there, but they're out of gas and they're just kind of stuck on an island, and the movie leaves and doesn't really get into it. And so I think, you know, Bryan Singer had it in mind, oh, okay, I'm going to be the one who directs sequels to this, and then the movie just didn't really connect well with people, because I think there needs to be a significant amount of action in a Superman movie. Like, you cannot have a Superman movie where he doesn't throw a punch. That's just kind of, like, it's inexcusable to action fans, and even Donner's stuff had a lot more action than...
Yeah, and I feel like, too, I mean, like, if I... beginning to think more and more, like, if you can, if all you, if the most common, like, praise for a movie is it's a lot like another movie, then you're in trouble. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. The best thing that can be said for Superman Returns is that it's a lot like the original Superman. It's like, well, the original Superman exists. You know what I mean? Like, not, that's not to say that, like, I mean, Drew McWeeny from HitFix had a great point about this that I loved, where he was like, fanboys really only want their, like, on-screen interpretations of superheroes in one color palette anymore, and that's, like, super gritty, which he's totally correct in saying that, like, that's not an interesting take on absolutely every character ever. Like, it's not right for everything. It's not a one-size-fits-all, like, now he has guns! But, but, like, that said, you know, you do, if not need to modernize things, it's like, why are we watching this beyond just... this movie, this other movie that I can already go get.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the kind of general feeling that I got watching this a second time. But, I mean, it is still, I'm kind of right there with you, DC. It's a movie that I can respect, but I don't necessarily like. We'll put it that way. But, that being said, the Blu-ray is really awesome. And I think this is probably the last I'm going to talk about this whole Superman thing for a long, long time.
Oh,
kind
man.
Of Supermaned out, as one can imagine from all of this stuff. But I cannot recommend this entire series, like, highly enough. If you guys are, like, people listening, diehard Superman fans, this is kind of a must-have for any collection. So that's all I'll say about that. But let's go ahead and move on into our review of Pulp Fiction.
Come on, let's get in character. I'm so interested in Big Man's wife. Well, he's going out of town in Florida, and he asked me if I take care of her while he's gone.
Take care?
No, man. Just show her a good time, make sure she don't get lonely.
Girl, you see, this is a moral test of oneself.
I do believe Marcellus, my husband, your boss, told you to take me out and do whatever I wanted. I love you so
much, can't count on. Whether or not you can maintain loyalty.
Night of the fight, you may feel a slight sting. Pride only hurts, it never helps. In the fifth, your ass goes down.
I have to say, play with matches, you get burned.
We should have shot glass for this kind of deal.
We're in a lot of danger, aren't we?
I'm prepared to scar the earth for that.
Oh, I'm sorry, did I break your concentration?
Get down, get down.
You got a corpse in a car, minus a head in the garage. Take me to it.
Don't you hate that?
Hate what?
Uncomfortable silences.
All right, so Pulp Fiction came out in 1994. It was co-written and directed by Quentin Tarantino. And let's just go around the circle real quick, talk about some general thoughts, maybe like your particular relationship with this movie, like if you've seen it a bunch of times or if it's your first viewing or whatever. So DC, let's start with you. What do you think about Pulp Fiction?
Well, my initial experience with Pulp Fiction, I don't remember exactly how old I was. I feel like I was like 12, though. And my grandma, my dad's mom, was babysitting us, and my parents were off on like vacation or something. And I remember we went to Blockbuster, and she's like, I've always described her as like my like cool granny, like she's just like, you know, kind of swinging and hip, or as hip as they get as far as grandmas go, and like goes to travels a bunch and all kinds of stuff. But so she was like, saw Pulp Fiction, and she was like, oh, let's get this. And I was like, fuck yeah, let's get this. Because I mean, A, it's like any R-rated movie that you get to see at that age, you're stoked.
Yeah.
But I feel like also I had heard about Pulp Fiction. It was probably like a year or two after it came out. And like you'd seen it like referenced on like The Simpsons and things like that. And you were just like very culturally aware of it, because it was just this like huge seismic event, I feel like, in culture. And so she rented it, and my two little brothers had already gone to bed, and she was like, let's watch it. And I was like, yeah. So we're watching it, and I think we're both sitting there just like aghast And especially now watching it again, I'm like, oh my God, like there is so much stuff that I was sitting and watching just like with my grandma, like uncommented upon, like in the dark in my living room. And then it got to a point, it got to the scene where the adrenaline shot scene, and like literally the moment where Uma Thurman, like the moment where he goes to give her the shot and he like stabs her in the heart and she sits up, my grandma just goes, I'm going to go to bed. And so she goes up and goes to bed, and I got to watch the rest of it myself. And it was like this just sort of hugely influential moment on me, because it A, had this wonderful sheen of like adultness, and like I got to watch it like by myself, and it was, you know, just hugely, hugely influential on me. So I probably watched it maybe in part or in whole, like 60 times between then and like by the time I finished high school.
Wow.
And then I hadn't seen it a ton after I went away to college. And this was my, I'll bet you this was my first whole viewing of the movie in a couple of years at the very least. And I also feel like this was the first, I watched it again on Friday night. This was the first time that I was watching it again in, since living in LA. And I feel like it's such an LA movie that it definitely like added a lot to the experience. But yeah, I mean, I just completely, this movie like launched me, this movie and Clerks kind of launched me on this whole like independent filmmaker kick when I was like 12, 13, where I was convinced that I wanted to be like a auteur, like writer, director, a la, you know, Kevin Smith or mm-hmm. Quentin Tarantino or whatever. And I just, you know, it is just totally become part of my lexicon still to this day. So nice. Big fan.
Cool. All right, Tyler, what'd you think?
My story's so lame compared to yours now. I watched bits of it in the 90s, and the soundtrack I remember having and listening to that a lot. And then this is watching it yesterday. First time I've watched it in like 10 years, so I'm a little behind.
I enjoyed it.
I'm sorry. I'm supposed to give my impressions.
Okay. All right. That's about as brief as they come. All right. I watched this, in like 2004 for the first time, I think, and had not seen it since then. I had this thing against Tarantino back then where I was just really bitter about him because I thought he was more of a hack than a real kind of original director. You know, he takes all of these elements, like in Reservoir Dogs, you know, the characters are named Mr. Pink, Mr. Orange, Mr. Brown, all these things. And I, you know, was like, I knew that had happened in movies before, and everybody was like praising it for being so original and all this kind of stuff. This is my like 2003, 2004 self talking here. And, I was like, you know, this has been done before. Like, why are people like praising him for doing these big homages? Which is just like, it seemed to me that all of his movies were just like, you know, pulling pieces of other movies together and putting it into one thing. And I was like, that's not really doing anything that original. So I just kind of had this bitterness to against Tarantino for a long time. When I saw Pulp Fiction the first time, I wasn't really that impressed with it because I didn't understand how influential it really was and how so many movies now, and especially like right after that, did the whole like narrative shifting thing with the time shifting and chronology, you know, like moving the chronology around. I didn't understand like how important this movie was in that whole grand scheme of things. And I don't know, I just kind of was like, whatever, Tarantino, like he's kind of a hack. So recently I watched Jackie Brown. This was like a couple years ago, and I was like, holy crap, wow, this is a really good movie. And I saw for the first time that Tarantino was able to not just take things from other movies and make it his own, but also reference these genres and make a movie that fits into that specific genre, which is like a very thin line to walk, but he definitely does it. And he does it here with Pulp Fiction in this kind of gangster genre too. So I have a lot more respect for this movie watching it now in my kind of post-bitterness phase of Tarantino.
Yeah, I feel like with him, because like you're right, I think that was in like the immediate rap against him was that like, oh, he just is like, it's just all homage. Like there's no, and it was funny too, because we were just talking about, you know, Superman Returns being this huge homage to the original mm-hmm. Superman. And there was this thing of like, well, if all you're ever doing is homage, then you're not really like making something that's truly original. And I do feel like that was basically, I feel like everybody's, if they didn't like him, they're like criticism of him. And then if they had never seen him, that just became the sort of parroted criticism. And Lord knows I'm like completely guilty of parroting tons of criticisms of things that I'm not actually really that experienced with.
Right.
But I feel like it was this sort of thing thing where, like everybody, when The Simpsons came out, like, your parents were like, oh, you can't watch that. Bart Simpson says, like, eat my shorts, and he's disrespectful to grown-ups. And, like, it was basically just this thing based on, like, the first two episodes of The Simpsons that parents got all up in arms over, and, like, t-shirts of Bart Simpson, where it's like, but the show itself was this incredibly, like, clever cultural satire that was, like, wholly original. And I feel like he's the, so what I'm saying is he's the Bart Simpson of culture, or of movies, where you're like, there is that rap against him. And, like, you know, Inglourious Basterds is this weird, not really a remake of another movie called Inglourious Basterds, but it's in this entirely original thing where it references shit tons of movies, even overtly sometimes. And yet it's this, he kind of weaves it into this wholly original thing that, like, but again, only he can do. He's the only one that I want to see do that because he's just so good at it.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I think, probably Boondock Saints is the movie that I can think of that is drawn, you know, the most negative comparisons Pulp Fiction came out.
Yeah.
Because of probably the whole, like, reciting the prayer, you know, that right. The McManus brothers do, which is very clearly just a ripoff of Samuel Jackson's, like, Ezekiel verse and stuff. And, like, I don't know, just the whole...
I am the Lord!
That's so funny. Though. I never really thought about that, but you're totally right. But the great thing about Boondock Saints, or not the great thing, I mean the great slash awful thing about Boondock Saints that you make that point is, like, he's doing it in, like, a very overt, serious way, like these super Catholic, awesome vigilantes, and you're supposed to think it's really cool. And then when, and it's a ripoff of Pulp Fiction, but, like, in Pulp Fiction, I was just noticing, and I never really thought about it before, but, like, he does that at the beginning of the movie, and then later when he's talking to Tim Roth's character in the diner, and he's like, you know, he says the shit again, and he's like, I used to just think that was some cold shit to say to a motherfucker before I killed him.
Yeah.
And he basically undercuts the entire thing. He's basically saying, like, yeah, I was trying to be a character in a movie. I was trying to be cool.
Yeah.
And I never really actually thought about what those words meant before. So I like that basically Tarantino cut the legs out from under it before the movie even ends, and then fucking Troy Duffy's going to go off and, like, actually, like, he doesn't get it. He's like, oh, I guess that is cool.
Yeah. Yeah, and that, you know, that's something that I noticed this time around, too, that I didn't really pay that much attention to for whatever reason the first time I watched this movie, is that, like, the Jules and Vincent, when before they go into Brett's apartment and do that big, like, interrogation scene and that whole, like, say what again, that whole thing, which is, like, one of my favorite scenes in movies, just because it's Samuel Jackson is so freaking awesome in it. But, like, one of the things they say in the hallway is, like, okay, let's get into character.
Yeah, totally.
And then, like, that whole revelation at the very end when he is sitting there at the table across from Tim Roth and there's, like, this awesome Mexican standoff and this tension, you don't really know what's happening, and you're watching Samuel Jackson's character go through this transformation, like, right there in front of you and, like, work all this stuff out as he's saying it and in this, like, really heightened, suspenseful situation. He's talking about, like, you know, right before that, he talks to Vincent at the table before, like, the whole gun thing, kind of the holdup happens. And he's like, man, you're just judging stuff the wrong way. Like, it's not important what happens. What's important about the – he's talking about the miracle, you know, when the guy comes out of the bathroom and supposedly shoots or tries to shoot them but ends up missing or whatever. And Jules considers that a miracle, and Vincent considers that just whatever, like a random act of coincidence or something. And Jules goes off and says, like, you're just judging this stuff the wrong way. It's not important what actually happened. What's important is that I felt the touch of God. And, like, that for some reason this movie, like, the way that – that stuff is brought up at the very end with this whole resolution of Samuel Jackson's character, I feel like it has a lot more interesting aspects to it than just him, you know, going off and yelling and looking cool in the beginning. Like, that's
a really, that's an excellent point. Absolutely. I think if you want to look at it in a certain, like, sort of film school-y way, which I totally am down for, you know, getting real artsy-fartsy about stuff all the time, I think you could interpret that in a way is, like, he's basically, like, saying, like, because there's all these events and things that get talked about in the movie where, you know, I think at the time it got praised a lot for, like, this very kind of almost realistic but also heightened banter where they're just talking about dumb shit like you talk about with your buddies, and then when Vincent's at dinner with me and they just talk about, like, uncomfortable silences and, like, stuff that we all experience and talk about. And, like, what Tarantino's basically doing with that stuff is, like, putting the touch of God onto it. And, like, that's also a thing I think that, like, I want to see no lesser filmmaker do, but I love when he does, is whether overtly or not overtly, he's basically saying, like, look at me, look at how great I am at doing this.
Yes.
Like at the end of Inglourious Basterds when he says, I think I made my masterpiece.
Yes.
And yes, he did. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I love that stuff. And that's a really good point that you draw there.
Yeah. I mean, he's essentially like the Babe Ruth of filmmakers. Like, he's able to call his shot and then Whoa. Capitalize on it. Like, he does what he promises that he is going to do. You know, he talks a huge game, but he is actually able to pull it off, which is the difference between him and seemingly every other, you know, kind
well,
of.
Well, and also you make a good point, too, about especially in the immediate wake of Pulp Fiction, like just the rafts and rafts of like. I remember when we were making Mystery Team, we applied to Sundance, but then we also applied to, like, what's the other one? Slam Dance. And yes. In Slam Dance is, like, what do you call it? Like, sort of, you know, criteria for when you're submitting your film. They're like, hey, we've seen a million guys with, you know, stoners with guns in the trunk of their car talking about pop culture shit movies. Don't submit any of those. Like, they're basically just, like, overtly, like, don't submit a Tarantino ripoff movie because basically every great thing has a million retarded children where people are just like, oh, I can do that. And you fucking can't because it's delicate.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to see if I can find – there's this – I was reading the Wikipedia page of Pulp Fiction afterwards, and this guy was talking about how he was – like judging movies and like a like kind of like something like that, like a film festival catalog or something, like reading or student films or something, and like the year after Pulp Fiction came out, there was like 7 of the 10 movies had hitmen like sitting around talking about random stuff, and like you know, that's the measure of importance that this movie had, and like the kind of drop in the water of whatever of cinema where this.
Well, that's
just, like,
why
this
I feel
ripple.
Like it's really great to watch now, because I feel like that tide hopefully has probably like receded a little bit, and you are able to just watch it like for what it is, and I just find it an infinitely rewarding movie. But you were talking about like Samuel Jackson's character. I was kind of thinking about it this time, and I was like, the reason that, because I was like, oh, you've seen him do this kind of thing now so many times, but why does it still like feel so like fresh when he does it in this movie, is like, I kind of feel like, you know how like Buffalo Bill Cody or whatever, like he had all these like crazy Old West exploits, but then he spent like his like later years just kind of like recreating his exploits and like sad like circusy kind of shows, like going from town to town.
Yeah.
Like I feel like that's Samuel L. Jackson now, and like Pulp Fiction is him actually having the exploits. Like it's just like he was given this really meaty, like amazing role, and then because of that, unfortunately, it feels like he has to go through like sort of sad facsimiles of it every time out now. Unfortunately, like he almost created this caricature, but within the movie of Pulp Fiction itself, he gets to do the caricature and be awesome, and then also like undercut it and be a guy as well, and just show his like full range.
Yeah, it's interesting, especially because of how many big-name people there are in this movie and how much, like, Tarantino uses the public perception of these specific actors, you know, to kind of either highlight or play off of their characters in this movie. Because, like, John Travolta, you know, there's that big dance scene and stuff. And, I mean, clearly, this movie is the one that's cited as revitalizing his career, and he had kind of dropped off the map for a long time, and like America still knew him as freaking Tony Manero from Saturday Night Fever, and like seeing him dance there with Uma Thurman, you're like, that's clearly something that Tarantino was using, you know, the public's perception of John Travolta in this movie. And like Bruce Willis is like this big action star, so he plays a boxer, and like he's stoic and he's got the Willis face and all that kind of, you know, the looks and things. And like, I feel like that kind of stuff is used as a tool by Tarantino, whereas lesser filmmakers might just do it because they recognize those actors for.
Yeah. Or they do it and be like, oh, now I have him in the role. I don't have to like do the work. You know what I mean? Like it's just going to take me there. I think you're totally right.
Yeah. Tyler, what do you think about like the Vincent Vega and Jules, those two characters and like their kind of trajectory throughout the movie, like that particular storyline, were you digging what they were doing, or were you like, okay, let's get to the other parts or what?
Yeah. Well, I thought it was kind of interrupted with the Golden Watch story because, well, really their partnership really didn't come to a head until the last portion of the film. Although you see a glimpse of it at the beginning. Yeah. Like the dialogue in this movie is so ridiculous and so quick and so meaningful that it's you know, it's fun to keep up with it. But Vincent and Jules, like, I think I laughed most at the latter part of the movie where they're just arguing with each other in this like blood drenched car.
Yeah.
And like just the dialogue between them, I think, is probably one of the funnier parts of this movie and probably why I like the movie so much. Although I think my favorite portion of the film was the Golden Watch story. I just thought that was just downright cool. Like this boxer that, you know, decides not to throw the fight now that all these gangsters are after him, and kind of like, you know, I kept thinking Sin City because that's the one that I really liked back in 2006. And, you know, it basically takes different characters, but the same format for a movie, same yeah. universe, but three different stories. So I really dug that. And, but these guys have just gone down in history as like the two badass characters that have ever come across film. So, yeah. And I'm not going to disagree with that at all.
Yeah, which is really interesting too, because when you look at them, they're also just when you really watch it, and especially when you watch it, I think the older and older you get. Like, I think when I was like really a kid, I just watched and was like, these guys are so cool. And then you watch it now, and you're like, they're fucking goofballs, man. Like yeah. They really are. Like, and they even, you know, they obviously have these characters they can get in where they can be really, really intimidating and like, you know, fucking Jules is going to like yell at you and say some cold Bible shit. And then like Vincent's just going to be back in the kitchen kind of smoking and like mumbling. And they have these things that in ways to get into your head. But like in their everyday lives, like they're total fuck ups. And like Jules is like come or not Jules. I'm sorry. Vincent's come back from Amsterdam. And I never really drew this out. But like he's clearly a heroin addict, or at least very into heroin.
Yeah.
And he thinks it's all going to be fine. And like it's funny watching it now. I never really thought about this. But like when he goes over to the Mia's house and to like pick her up, it's like he's stoned on heroin.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like
yeah.
To get through it or whatever. But like he goes through that entire date in this weird like haze almost. And you just look at those guys and you're kind of like they're all, I don't know, it's with the boxer, like Butch, and with like Jules and like all these guys, it's basically about, I don't know, I'm very into the theme of like obsolescence. So that's what I took out of it. And like when people or things are like obsolete and how they either embrace that or kind of like struggle against that. And I kind of feel like it's a story a lot in a lot of ways that's about that exact thing. Cause you have this guy Butch who he's like, it's your time is past and you got to just accept that. But he decides like, no, I'm not going to, I'm going to like, you know, I actually am going to kill this other dude in the ring. Not that he means to, but like, yeah. And then you have like Jules or no, I'm sorry, again, Vincent, like who's come back from Amsterdam. And he even says at one point, like I was noticing, he's like, this is not my town. Like LA is not his town. He doesn't mm-hmm. know how it works here. Yeah. And then he ends up getting killed. He's reading some dumb French book in the bathroom.
Spoiler
instead
alert.
Of his gun.
Yeah. Well, the spoilers. Yeah, that's totally fine. He's joking. But, I think, joking. Like that's the part, the one part that I didn't quite, I don't think Tarantino spells out for us, because that's the scene I'm glad you brought this up, because my girlfriend was asking me about this yesterday, because she recently watched it as well. And like the part when Butch comes back to get the watch, right, and Vincent is in the restroom and he comes out and just gets blown away, which is like an awesome payoff to their whole like bar scene, like mano y mano, like macho bullshit yeah. that they do, which I found really interesting watching that this time, because I was like, man, normally in a face-off like that, one person will back down eventually. And even though that's a really short scene, nobody gives an inch. And, like, it just – the situation kind of gets dissolved because Marcellus calls Vincent over. But I was just like, mm-hmm. man, like, that scene is so good, just because he's like, you looking at something? And he's like, you heard what I said. Like, you know, they've just – neither one of them gives an inch. So I thought that was really great. But, you know, it obviously gets paid off where Butch comes out on top at the end by just freaking blowing Vincent away with that submachine gun or whatever. But that part in the movie, in the chronology, obviously takes place after the
obviously, because he comes back to life.
Right,
not
right.
5 minutes later.
Yeah, so I guess it's just and also it's after – let's see. I'm just trying to figure out the chronology. So basically,
the first story, he goes out on the date. That's got to be after the scene where they clean up the car.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
And then the boxing story comes after everything.
Yeah. You see them in that face off scene that you're talking about in the bar. They're in the goofy shit that they picked up at Marvin. Is it Marvin? No, Marvin's
Jimmy.
Jimmy's
Jimmy.
Yeah.
Marvin's head blew up.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
So, no, yeah, but basically I just mean, like, there's not a, you know, he doesn't really spell it out for us, which is good, because I like kind of thinking about this stuff. But basically what happens is, like, after after they get the briefcase back to Marcellus and all that stuff, he just, you know, that part where Vincent is in the Butch's bathroom is the last part, chronologically speaking. So he must have gotten back into his suit and, like, just it goes back to work for Marcellus doing more random things, which they don't talk about in the movie, but I think that's just, like, the kind of implied, okay, things are back to normal at this point. But that, you know, since
Marcello
there's not...
kills them rapists.
Yeah, since there's not a scene that shows things going back to normal and all that stuff playing out, I was just, it kind of threw me for a loop for a second. But, I mean, this movie, like, the way it messes with time is really awesome, because, like, I was reading about the making of it and stuff, and they were talking about taking it to, I think, Columbia or TriStar, or actually they might have been one and the same at that point still, and, like, the executives, when they read the script, were like, this doesn't make sense, characters are alive and then they're dead in the next scene, and then they come back, and, like, this is retarded, I can't do this, or whatever. So they just kind of, like, ended up passing on the script or whatever. But obviously,
that's a good impression.
The one, yeah, an impression of a random studio executive.
Well, he'd also just had jaw surgery, that executive, so he was very
possibly a stroke.
I don't know.
Probably should see a doctor.
Yeah,
shouldn't be reading.
But I mean, obviously, yeah, I think we're all glad that the Weinsteins kind of took some, you know, took heart in the script and thought saw some good stuff coming out of it. But Tarantino probably earned that with Reservoir Dogs, which I just watched again for the second time in at least 10 or 15 years or something. And I really, really like Reservoir Dogs. Tyler, I know you haven't seen that one, but if you liked Pulp Fiction, definitely check that out. DC, what do you think about Reservoir Dogs?
I watch in my... See, Jackie Brown is the one of his that I haven't seen enough for how good it is. Mm-hmm. Like, it's kind of like I grew up loving and watching Goodfellas over and over again, but I never really watched Casino. And then now I feel like I'm in my Casino period of life.
Yeah.
Like, I watched Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs tons. But I have only still to this day only seen Jackie Brown like 3 or 4 times. But Reservoir Dogs, I really liked a lot, although I watched it all over, you know, over and over again and would quote it, and it worked itself into my lexicon as well. Like the part where he says, like, just keep saying it and saying it and saying it. Yeah, just like shit you would quote with your friends and whatever.
Yeah.
But, I feel like, I don't know. I have to watch Reservoir Dogs again. Obviously I just came off this high of watching Pulp Fiction again. So I do feel like Pulp Fiction is in a lot of ways, the more mature movie, and a lot of ways, the more like when you give this guy pretty much all the tools that he needs to use, like what he's going to deliver for you as far as the movie goes. Whereas Reservoir Dogs, I feel like, does feel like a little bit more of a first feature, in that it feels a little more confined by like budget and locations.
Yep.
And, you know, also just, you know, a little bit of immaturity to a degree. Like Pulp Fiction feels fully formed, at least in my mind. Whereas Reservoir Dogs, there is a certain amount of very charming, but like fetal first film kind of stuff.
And it seems to me like he just doesn't really know when to rein it in as much in Reservoir Dogs as he does here, because that's another big criticism, I think, of Tarantino, is that, like, he loves to hear himself talk and he loves to hear his characters deliver his dialogue. And there's not really that many scenes in Pulp Fiction where it drags on so long that I was like, dear God, just wrap it up. We get it already. It seemed like a lot of the stuff was very, you know, it was kind of organic to the story. Like in Death Proof, his part of the grindhouse thing, I did not like that movie just because there's so much talking that's like totally seemingly irrelevant to like the movie itself and like what these characters are about to do and what's happening. And it's just like them sitting around talking for no apparent reason. And that I feel like Pulp Fiction is probably Tarantino's most accessible movie because there's not a lot of that. Yeah, the dialogue is very stylized and they do talk about ridiculous things and the stuff that we've talked about before. But I feel like it's all character building stuff as opposed to just Tarantino like kind of being masturbatory.
Yeah, I've actually never seen Death Proof. I've always meant to, but yeah, I have heard that is like the knock against it. Have you seen Four Rooms?
I have seen Four Rooms, yeah.
That was another one that it used to be on IFC all the time. So when I was in high school, I would watch it a ton, but I would mostly watch like because it's like this like whatever you would call it. I don't know what you would, you like know, this anthology kind of, movie that a bunch of different directors have made, these like four different stories that all feature Tim Roth's bellboy character on some night at this like weird hotel on New Year's Eve. Mm-hmm. And Tarantino's one in that I still think is really good, even though it is super masturbatory and it does like feature him in the central role. And is apparently he even says it in the thing is basically a restatement of a like Twilight Zone episode.
Yeah.
But it's just in terms of the way he sustains tension in a scene like he does in like the big Kahuna Burger scene in Pulp Fiction, or like the opening scene in Inglourious Basterds, like just as a single scene it just works so well, just in terms of like building tension, where I'm like, you could have always knocked the guy for referencing a whole bunch of different movies and pop culture stuff, but like how can you knock how good he is at building tension within a scene just using like the language of film as we could.
Yeah, and in Four Rooms in particular, there's this one really, really long shot that I remember that he uses, and I think he does that really well in Pulp Fiction as well. There's a couple times where his camera will just sit there and freaking linger on Uma Thurman as they're sitting in that in Jackrabbit Slims. You know, he builds not only like normal tension but sexual tension as well, like by just by using his camera and letting these long takes play out and letting the actors kind of do their thing, which, you know, you don't see enough of these days because of the whole ADD MTV style editing thing, which, you know, whatever, I don't care if that makes me sound like what that makes me sound.
No, but you know what's cool is I feel like that I think when people actually, it's like no one would pick it out of a lineup and be like, yeah, I either want to see really long takes of stuff or I want to see like quick cuts. But I feel like the public gets this reputation as being really into needing things fast. But I think that's just Hollywood thinking that they think things need to be fast. You know what I mean? More than it is like, because like when Bastards came out, like it was essentially this like indie movie. I mean, you know, obviously it has Brad Pitt and like Nazis and stuff in it, but it was a real, it did really, really well, and people kept going to see it, I think largely because it is such an old-fashioned, and that's a fucking, that's a movie that's like 2.5 hours long and mostly in French with subtitles, which people supposedly don't like to go to the movies to read, but it did really well with like people, like everyone, because it was just a, I like to think it had Brad Pitt in it and it was really fun and funny, but like it just is because he's good at building tension within scenes, and we actually, that is actually what we like to see.
Yeah, totally. I think that's probably the biggest strength of Inglourious Basterds in particular, is just like the scenes where people are sitting around a table talking. There's so much tension in those scenes than anything else. But
what's the deal with the foot fetish thing that everyone always talks about?
Well, I mean,
saw a lot of that in Pulp Fiction.
Did you notice it in this?
It was very heavy.
Right?
Like just camera shots of people's feet is just blatant that this guy.
Yeah.
Well, and the whole foot massage dialogue.
Yeah.
The foot massage dialogue, and then her walking around the room while he's waiting for her downstairs, like, and then she like bends her jiffy feet in a weird way. That was kind of gross.
Yeah.
And just lots of feet.
Yeah.
Yeah. Her on the dance floor. She's in bare feet.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, like, can you blame him? I guess on one level. I mean, I don't have a foot fetish, but like, you know, Uma Thurman.
They were pretty jiffy though.
Tyler, is that
Jiffy,
like a
Jiffy, of course, to define Jiffy feet is when you walk around barefoot everywhere and you just pick up dirt as if you're walking around in like a gas station.
Right.
And the bottoms of your feet are just, you know, horribly dirty.
I hadn't heard that before.
I'm from the backwoods, so we call it Jiffy feet.
Yeah, I was gonna say that seems like an
Jiffy
old,
is like a gas
perhaps
station.
We should update it to Swiffer feet.
An old Appalachian phrase.
Yeah. that Uma's at it again. She running around with no shoes on.
Feet.
Yeah. It definitely is something that's overt in, like, you know, Kill Bill. There's a lot of loving, lingering shots of Uma Thurman feet, like Inglourious Basterds. There's obviously the whole weird shoe thing with Diane Kruger's feet. I think it's Diane Kruger. Where she ends up dying in that scene, and it's super weird. She's getting choked and shit.
Yeah.
Supposedly by Tarantino's hands off screen. Supposedly those aren't Christoph Waltz's hands. Those are Tarantino's actual hands. Creepy. But yeah, I mean, like, I cannot begrudge the guy his obsessions, because when he gets really obsessed with stuff, that's when we get really good movies. So I can deal with some foot fetish stuff if it means movies like this.
Yeah.
You would think he'd strangle her with his feet.
Yeah.
That would be pretty difficult, I think. But so
and you just clamp down like a vice grip.
Let's talk about The whole kind of redneck WTF moment when you see the Gimp released from this cage when, like, Marcellus and Butch get, like, just kind of, they're brawling in the street and they stumble into a random pawn shop which happens to be owned by these kind of KKK, like, weird...
They're rapists, Ben.
Yeah, rapist southerners, basically. And, which I think, I don't know, probably says something a little bit about the city of Los Angeles, too.
Possibly inbred. we don't know.
But well, like, I'm actually broadcasting live from that actual pawn shop. They've unzipped my GIMP mask.
Oops, but, sorry, guys.
Yeah, I'm blowing their cover right now.
Don't mean to, you know, insult you in any way.
So, I mean...
Keep trucking.
Tyler, what was your first reaction, like, when you saw that scene? Did you remember that from your first viewing, or...
Not really. I think my parents might have turned it off by then. maybe like I had to leave the room or something. Yeah, but having watched the first half of this movie, I wasn't really surprised that, oh, okay, there's, you know, some really weird rapists and a, you know, S&M character that's going to guard Bruce Willis as he's getting his butthole penetrated.
Right.
But yeah, I'm glad it didn't go too graphic, although it was pretty graphic. It could have gone too graphic.
Well, yeah, that's the thing.
And it's, you'll, like, know when it's too graphic.
I didn't remember this, like, the specifics of that scene. I obviously remember that it happened, but I was like, man, I hope this doesn't really get too into it, just because, I mean, seriously, who wants to watch a dude raping another dude? But what they did...
Any thoughts on that? I'm sorry. Edit that out. I'm sorry.
I'm not.
No.
Keeping it in.
You're right, Tyler. I enjoyed it. I said, where's the Blu-ray so I can see all the outtakes and the things that hit the cutting room floor. There's fan fiction.
A lot of things hit the cutting room floor.
The GIMP fan fiction.
I guess I am speaking from a place where I, Dan Ekman, the guy who directed Mystery Team, he directed this like MTV made-for-TV movie that came out in May called Worst Prom Ever that me and Maggie, the producer of Mystery Team, co-produced. We were like creative producers on it. And one of the things creatively that we kind of were able to, because there was this character, this like drug dealer that was supposed to be real kind of fucked up. And in the initial script, he was just kind of very cartoonishly fucked up. And we were like, if he's going to be fucked up, I mean, it's not going to be, you know, it's never going to be rocket science. It's this like MTV kind of thing. But like, we definitely want him to be fucked up in a specific way. So one of the things that ended up getting worked in there is a Pulp Fiction style, guy in a gimp suit who's just kind of around and never explained, who sort of turned into the villain's like, sidekick essentially, which was, I guess, our sort of like homage. So speaking as somebody who's had a GIMP in an actual movie, they're just good fun. I mean, that's just money on screen right there. Anytime you get a guy in a GIMP suit.
Yeah. Yeah. I think my favorite part, what's that title?
Yeah, they do.
The audience loves that stuff.
Lines around the block for GIMPs.
It's a whole mythology that just a lot of people don't know about.
No, they don't. The GIMPs actually have, there's a Pulp Fiction version, or a GIMP version of Pulp Fiction where it's just bring out the person, and everyone else in it is in a GIMP suit, and then they just bring out a normal guy.
Interesting.
Speaking of
what
Twilight
an interesting
Zone
take.
Episodes.
How do they speak? Do they just unzip every time?
No, well, they just go, and then there's subtitles. But the subtitles are in French. A lot of people don't know that.
They'd have to be, because that's what the public wants, as we discussed earlier.
I know. I'm
French subtitles.
You.
They want to read that stuff.
Man. All right. Well, my favorite, trying to get some sort of semblance of order back into this conversation.
I like this idea. I'm writing it down. Gimps in movies.
Speak in French.
That could be like a Taschen like coffee table book. It's just a GIMP cinema, just a history of GIMPs throughout film.
Let's get on that. Let's make that happen.
And the Metropolis.
No, but it's to try to get some semblance of the. I did notice, like, it was interesting when I saw Inglourious Basterds. I was like, oh, this dude loves France, huh? Like, there was just, you know, so, and, you know, a lot of the movie takes place in Paris and different parts of France and stuff like that, and like a lot of it's in French, and I just kind of came out of nowhere for me. But then watching Pulp Fiction again, I was like, oh, this guy's always loved Europe and France. Like, it could not be it takes place in LA obviously and is kind of about LA in a lot of ways, but there could not be more discussion or influence of like a lot of European countries, but I feel like France in particular. In Pulp Fiction. So I guess it's like, it should not have come as such a surprise to me that he was such a Europophile.
Yeah. I think my favorite scene in that moment is like the choosing of the weapons that Bruce Willis does, you know, like he kind of lifts up this hammer and then he goes to
a
baseball bat or something. And then like the chainsaw. And it's like, you know, it's kind of clear that these are all things that have been seen, you know, just like the whole rest of the movie. These are things that have been used in other movies as you know, tools of violence. That's like what he's doing there is kind of, or what I thought he was doing there is kind of, you know, making us remember these movies. Like when he picks up the chainsaw, it's like impossible not to think of The Evil Dead, you know?
I thought Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
There you go. That too. I mean, that's what I'm saying.
Cause I thought this whole scene was like a horror, almost like a horror sidestep from this movie that we're watching, where it's kind of like dialogue heavy and mobster ish. But then all of a sudden we have these guys like tied up, about to be just harassed viciously, and it's kind of like, I don't know, like a hostile kind of, you know, teen, not a teen scream, but one of those more serious, you're about to get gutted horror films.
Yeah.
Where he's like on the, you know, you're on the edge of your seat if they're going to get out or get killed.
Yeah. And you know, him choosing the samurai sword or whatever, I was reading this one guy saying something, I don't remember the exact quote, so I'm just paraphrasing. I don't even know who it was, so I'm paraphrasing a guy that I have no idea who it is.
Just
so.
Use the exec impression, the executive impression.
This guy thinks. But anyway, this one guy, this one time, was saying that the reason that he picks a sword in the end was because it kind of associates Bruce Willis's character with like this kind of sense of honor, you know, like kind of calling back to all these old samurai movies and stuff. Yeah. And like at this point when
I concur,
me too. At this point when Butch could very easily just walk out of the door and he's in it for a crap ton of money and his life basically with Marcellus, he decides to go back and save the guy. So I think a sword
honor
is probably,
among thieves. Huh?
Yeah, exactly. A sword is probably the best choice.
And I have to say, as a just as a thing to say, when you live in LA, you can't go wrong with you lost all your LA privileges, which I used to quote even before I lived in Los Angeles, but now is extra super special fun.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of there's a lot of little LA things because, you know, I've only been living out here, it's like less than 2 years now, but like just watching these characters walking around different apartment complexes and stuff, there's like a universality to what an LA apartment complex looks like.
Yeah. Totally. I had a similar experience, like where it was really enriched by like living in LA now. And like, you're totally right. And like, I even wrote down like the sound design when they're in either the first apartment complex, when they go to like the Frank Whaley, Brett, his apartment. And then when Butch, goes back to his apartment, to get the watch off of the kangaroo, like the sound design when they're in the hallways and just, you can hear like little kids playing and like TVs and stuff, and it just feels just so right. It just is something that, like, if it hadn't have been in there, nobody probably would have noticed, but it's just so lovingly detailed that is just I don't know. And just even in the location scouting, just so like this, because like you always watch movies that ostensibly take place in LA and were clearly shot here, and like this is a knock that I would put against, like, you know, certain like Judd Apatow produced movies that I even like, but like when you see characters that are in LA that are supposedly like, oh, this guy is like a intern at a place and then he lives in this like super nice apartment,
and he works at Capitol
have
Records,
Bruce Willis, and he lives in this like shitty apartment complex. You know what I mean? Like, it's just so like, nothing is taken for granted, and everything is like actually what gritty actually means instead of just like gritty.
Yeah,
I don't know.
And also, like, you know, it's set in LA, but there's not a ton of like LA monuments really featured in it. So it's just kind of like the normal LA, like the in between places. I was listening to this interview with Sean Ryan, who's the creator of The Shield and Chicago Code and stuff. And he was talking about The Shield and how he really wanted that show to take place, you know, not in downtown and Hollywood and these other, you know, places. He wanted it in the fringes so you could see those places in the background, but he wanted the places that hadn't really been captured on film or, you know, in TV shows and stuff before. And I feel like that's a little bit what Tarantino does here, where he doesn't have characters like strolling down Hollywood Boulevard and all this, like, you know, stuff that you see in every movie that supposedly takes place in LA. He just kind of, it's clear that he's from here. He loves this area. They mentioned Toluca Lake at one point. That's like such a, like a tiny little offshoot of Burbank, like just an area that you wouldn't really, you know, it's just totally unassuming area, but that's where, like, the wolf is from and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, yeah, there's the movie is like a kind of a love letter to L.A. in a lot of ways, I think.
But. Yeah, absolutely. Or just in just like them not having, like, when they need to get the car off the road. And he's like, I don't have anyone in this area. Like,
yeah.
You feel like that in L.A. Like, oh, sometimes as like an actor, I'll like go to an audition and it'll be in some weird part of town I've never been to before. And then I'll get out and I'll want to get lunch. And then I'm like, I don't have anyone in this area. I don't know how to, you know, I don't know how it works over here. Like, that is a very real thing. Like, when you're not familiar with a particular area or whatever. Yeah, it is very, like, the geography of it is very kind of loving and nonspecific. And that's a good point about this movie and The Shield, like you were talking about. It's like, before I lived here, it was kind of, they were like two touchstones of like the times I'd been out here. I was like, that's how it actually feels, as opposed to like in movies that supposedly take place here but are very candy painted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
I love movies that are set in LA.
Tyler is the one non-LA resident of this podcast, but
I have this idea of like a post-apocalyptic LA from those gritty 1980s like movies,
yeah,
usually involving aliens or monsters or something.
Mm.
So that's what I'm hoping I'm gonna see.
like battle LA. It's exactly like battle LA.
Okay.
Hollywood.
Okay. Cool.
There's constantly aliens trying to come in.
In that it looks more like Louisiana than actual Los Angeles.
Oh, was that shot in Louisiana?
Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah. You know what? I take that back. There, and this is a super brief aside, but I thought they did a really good job in creating Santa Monica in Battle Los Angeles, because that's one of those places where,
like, CG creating,
creating using sets or whatever they had to do, green screen stuff. I thought it actually looked pretty convincing for being shot across the country.
It's going to be interesting, like, with, because I feel like when we grew in like the sort of 80s movies we grew up on, especially like what our idea of like Anytown USA was, which I think was in a lot of cases created by like Spielberg movies that were largely about and shot in like the Valley a lot of times, and like Northridge and stuff like that. And that kind of suburbia, like now with tons of things being shot in, say, Louisiana, like that's where we shot Worst Prom Ever. And we were supposedly, you know, we were just kind of charged with creating this like Anytown USA. So we would have to not pick places that looked particularly Louisianan, but like you can't help but include some little regionalism. So it's just interesting to me to like think of what will this generation's like movie generated picture of like an Anytown be.
Yeah.
Because everyone has them, even if it looks totally different than where you're actually growing up, you kind of get it in your head, like, this is what like a town looks like.
Yeah.
Totally. So like it'll be interesting to see. What's up, Town?
I said, like in Thor, wasn't that filmed somewhere else? And it was supposed to be in
New
Mexico
or something.
New Mexico, yeah.
Yeah.
Where was it actually filmed?
I think that was actually filmed in New Mexico, but I don't know where it was actually supposed to be set.
Yeah, I think it was
like a small town kind of thing.
Yeah, well, that's actually part of what I liked about Thor. Like, it did feel like such a backlot. I mean, even though it was, I guess, shot in New Mexico or whatever, like, the setting and the town that it took place in just did feel like something you would go to on a Universal Studios tour.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it had been a movie I didn't like, I would have been a knock against it probably, but because I did like it, I kind of gave it the benefit of the doubt for that, and the fact that the whole town felt like they had built it for the movie. Maybe they didn't. Maybe it's a real town. Sorry if that's insulting if you live there. But it did, I don't know, it was neat to see it get blown up just because it did feel so artificial.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. It felt like you could just walk up and push a wall and the whole thing
exactly.
In Blazing Saddles or something. But
the other movie that comes to mind is Slither, with the little town that the slugs attack.
Which is an episode
I don't remember what town that was supposed to be.
Yeah, well, I mean, speaking of
Pleasantville,
town, like,
perhaps
the kind of the perfect like representation of what DC is talking about, I think, is like Super 8, which, you know, was actually shot in West Virginia, and it was supposed to be this kind of Ohio town or whatever. And DC, this is something that I even wrote in my review of the movie, so I'm not, like, pandering to you, but I think that's something that you guys did really, really well in Mystery Team, which is, like, you know, kind of this that whole Amblin callback to, like, this town that's just, like, kids riding around on bikes and stuff, and it just has that thing that you were just talking about of, like, this is what our mind's eye view of a town looks like.
Oh, thank you, Ben. That's really cool. Like, I definitely, that is something I do think. What's that?
Sounds like pandering.
And it worked. cha-ching. that's really sweet of you to say. I mean, that is something I think Super 8 did well, and it's also something that, like, we endeavored to do, like, I'm from Arizona originally, so my picture of suburbia looks nothing like the one depicted in Mystery Team, but it was shot in Dan, the director, and Maggie, the producer, their, like, hometown, and, like, even at their high school that they went to in, like, some scenes and whatever, and, like, in Maggie's backyard where her parents still live, and, like, all these different places where it is their experience of, like, growing up and stuff like that. And we kind of, and Dan worked really hard to try to make it, like, especially in the beginning, like, this kind of Norman Rockwell-y feeling thing, which is, like, that's how these kids, like, view their town. And then hopefully it, like, decays throughout and they do their own version of stumbling into this, like, back room of a gun store where they're going to get raped. Yeah. Metaphorically.
Yeah, definitely. Tyler, is there anything else you wanted to bring up regarding Pulp Fiction before we wrap this up?
No, I can give my concluding thoughts.
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, really awesome movie if you like violence. Maybe you don't like rape so much, but that's okay because it's not that graphic. If you like Samuel L. Jackson, this movie, I'm just saying as some examples, this movie is really awesome all around. Great soundtrack, great scenes, great non-linear storytelling. If you can keep up with the dialogue, it's very enjoyable to watch and to listen to. Thank you.
Cool. DC, any concluding thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, like, I was just really happy that you guys invited me on to do this, and when I first heard Pulp Fiction, I was like, oh, it honestly is like a take-it-for-granted movie for me, because I watched it so much when I was in high school, and then I think, too, like, you do kind of try to differentiate yourself from who you were when you were first getting into film, and you're like, mm-hmm. Oh, I was too big of a nerd, I was too big into Tarantino and whatever, so I went through, a 4-year period where I didn't think about him very much. Even though I really liked Kill Bill and stuff like that, and I haven't seen Death Proof, but then when Bastards came out, I was like, oh, this guy is the guy, and hopefully will always be the guy. So
yeah,
I really relish the chance to go back and watch Pulp Fiction. I mean, like, the goofy little things that I wrote down when I was watching it, like, I felt like the quote for me that kind of sums up the movie is, personality goes a long way. Which is a line I never really noticed before, but that to me sums up the entire film. It's like, he's taking all these things that in anyone else's hands would totally fly apart, and it just works and is a total, like, I don't know, monolith of film as far as I'm concerned. Also, the other little interesting thing I wanted to, didn't really come up in our conversation, but I noticed that I never noticed before, is, like, you don't see any cops in the movie. They're just talked about a lot.
Yeah.
But I think I'm correct. Like, you never see, even when they're getting into, like, crazy car crashes on the street and whatever, and when they're talking about cops and they have this, like, they got to get the car off the road and stuff like that, like, you never actually see law enforcement, which I thought was such an interesting kind of, like, clearly a choice because they talk about them a bunch.
Yeah, and you hear sirens and stuff in the background sometimes, but you never actually see anybody. And I think that was one of the big criticisms of the movie. You know, we were talking about this whole, like, public perception of, you know, the kind of the Simpsons comparison of, like, oh, Tarantino, he's just violent and kind of a...
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. That's what this movie does really well, I think, is kind of breaks down those perceptions. Like, if those people who are complaining about the movie being violent for violence's sake actually watched the movie, they would see that it totally undercuts that. Because Vincent, at one point, he freaking shoots Marvin in the face by accident. And it's, like, hugely gory, disgusting moment, and there's blood everywhere, and then Tarantino decides to spend the next 20 minutes or what, 30 minutes or whatever, having this detailed scene of cleaning this stuff up.
Yeah.
Like, the guys are spraying it all down, and then, like, they're in this filth and disgusting stuff that is not cool by any stretch of the imagination.
No, they're actually having, you're totally right, that's a great point, they're actually having to deal with the literal physical nitty-gritty, like, in the upholstery, like, consequences of it, in what is easily a movie, a scene that is funnier than 99% of comedies in history.
Yeah.
Like, the whole movie is just so funny, but that scene in particular with the wolf and everything and is just so good.
Yeah, because you would think, you know, these people, I'm sure, were claiming, like, back then that, like, oh, you know, this movie is made, you know, kind of glorifies violence and stuff, but it really doesn't, because it shows, like, this kind of, that's the thing about the cops, is, like, it doesn't necessarily show the consequences of breaking the law, but it does show the consequences of, like, screwing up. And
it also just shows, it kind of deglamor, it, like, while it does glamorize these guys in a way, it also very much deglamorizes them, because, like I said, they're goofballs, and it makes it clear that they're just, like, they're working men, essentially, and they're also working men with an expiration date where they could be killed at any time, but they don't really get, like, There was a point actually in that Meyrin movie that I was watching, the first one, where in the very first scene he like meets this big gangster dude, and he goes and he's just got this shitty little office, and the guy's like, if you live in this business, if you succeed, this is what you get. And he kind of gestures to like this little shitty office, and he's like, if you don't, you're just dead. Like, yeah. And that's kind of what they're depicting in this movie. It's like, yeah, maybe you get to be Marcellus, but like more than likely you just get shot and like killed like in a bathroom.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? While the smoke detector's going off. Like it does, like, while it glamorizes them in a way, it also intensely like deglamorizes them and make it, hey, they're just like us.
Yeah, totally. Awesome. Yeah, that essentially wraps up my thoughts as well. I'm a big fan of this movie, and I think you know, if you were like me and hadn't seen it in a long time, I would definitely recommend giving it another viewing. And if you were also like me, who maybe at one point or right now don't really care for Tarantino, I would say give it another shot and just kind of look at it maybe from it with a different, with a fresh pair of eyes or whatever that
is. It's on Netflix Instant too, which I was totally stoked to find out. A lot of the Miramax stuff is, I think, very recent on there.
Yeah, that's how I watched Reservoir Dogs like 2 days ago too, because that's on Instant as well. So, and by the way, it looks really great, like streaming Instant for some reason. I was just like, wow, I was kind of surprised with how awesome the quality of that was. But
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so definitely, I mean, Pulp Fiction is, a monolith, as DC said, so I like that description of it. Tyler, why don't you go ahead and rev up the Apple II and let us know what we're going to be watching next week.
Sure, no problem. DC, we have an old-time Apple II that selects our next movie for us.
Oh, sweet.
With a comically large lever that I pull.
Right, go ahead and pull that lever.
Of course, no one can see it because we're a podcast. Okay, I'm pulling it now. Big Lebowski, right?
Yes, it's the Big Lebowski.
Okay, next week we'll be watching the Big Lebowski with none other than the aforementioned Jeff Bridges.
Nice.
John Goodman, Sam Elliott, a bowling alley, and some good times.
Oh, that is easily, probably my favorite movie of all time, I think. Wow. Also another great LA movie.
Man.
Well, DC, why don't you come on back? I'll have you on for next week.
If you'll have me, I'll do it. If you want this much bloviating again, if you want this much fucking film school like art bag talk, I'll be around.
Just more Shaft jokes is all I'm looking for.
I'll write them all week. I'll be in the lab working on Shaft.
Excellent. Working in the lab. There we go.
Brilliant. All right. Well, you guys.
Some real determination around here, Ben. That's what we need.
Okay. All right. Enough of that. Okay. All right. You guys can subscribe to this podcast for free in iTunes. Leave us a review. That would be great. You can check us out on Facebook. We're on Twitter at twitter.com/NJNM podcast. We've got a couple new followers that I wanted to announce really quickly. Miyaka 912. Oh, look, it's Maddie. Char Color NSVS, Augustina Hovda 2, and Kino Katie. So thanks for the followers there, guys.
I think one of those are a porn star, so.
Okay, so if you're.
Possibly.
If you're that desperate, you can go and check out our Twitter.
Chances are, yes.
So you guys can also feel free to email us at notjustnewmovies@gmail.com, or you can call us and leave a voicemail. If you do leave a voicemail, which you can do at 904-469-6566, you might sound something like this.
Hello. Let me be the first to introduce myself. My name is Christopher Walken, and I recently discovered your podcast on my tunes, and I was so taken that I felt I needed to call in and tell you a little joke. Ahem. Well, what do you get when you rub two orange slices together? You don't even know. You get Pulp Friction. Thank you. I'm pretty confident I got hearty laughs from your audience. I wanted to help you. So until next time, I'll be back when you do a double feature of Nick of Time and Balls of Fury. Tally ho, Shoeless Joe.
Man, Christopher Walken calling in. We are upping our quality left and right here, getting the celebrity guests and freaking people calling in. I think Connery has called in a couple times, so yeah.
Yep.
I'm starstruck.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Mr. Walken. That's fantastic. And Pulp Friction, that is brilliant if I've ever heard it.
Yeah,
I would like
it's
to think that
joke.
If you asked him about that joke, he would be like, he would know the joke because he obviously said it, but he would not get that it was a Pulp Fiction reference. He just thought it was funny in and of itself. He's completely forgotten he's been in a film.
He had no idea that we were talking about Pulp
Fiction. I have a whole book of pulp-related jokes, oranges and grapefruit and the like.
I've been sponsored by the orange juice people. From Florida.
Sunny D, it's a good summer fun time.
Oh, Lord, this is getting off the rails.
Wow, pretty good, pretty good.
Man, there haven't been rails.
Yeah,
you know,
no, you're right.
In a long time.
I just like to pretend that I'm serious and taking this seriously, but no, I relish the moments where they go off the perceived rails. So let's go ahead and wrap up the... What's that, Tyler?
Nothing. Terrible. Terrible joke.
All right, that's what we're known for. Let's go ahead and wrap up the character name game. The name was Frank D'Amico, and can you guys think of what movie that character might be from?
I know this. I know Frank D'Amico.
Do you know it?
I
can't place the movie, though.
So it's a movie that came out this week, but
no.
it's related to a movie that came out this
week?
Yeah,
it's related. Like a character in... who like the character, the guy who plays Frank D'Amico was in a movie that came out this past weekend. That's the connection.
Was it just Friends?
It's not just Friends. But
is it Waiting?
Green Lantern. Green Lantern is the movie that this guy is from.
Oh, interesting. Okay, Green Lantern. I don't know. Frank D'Amico. The name sounds familiar. It, you know what? Honestly, the first thing that leaped to mind was Dog Day Afternoon. It sounds like he'd be like the third cop in that. but I doubt that Ryan Reynolds was in Dog Day Afternoon.
No,
and I think it was Tim Robbins. Tim Robbins' character in.
Nope, it's not. The movie is it came out in 2010. It's a superhero movie that's kind of a deconstruction of the superhero genre. Not necessarily. It's not Watchmen, but that was
Kick-Ass. Oh, Kick-Ass.
Yes, Kick-Ass.
Frank D'Amico.
Yes, Frank D'Amico was the character played by Mark Strong, who is the villain.
In
Kick-Ass, he was also. The character of Sinestro in Green Lantern that came out in wide release this past weekend. So,
oh my God, did you guys see Sinestro put on the yellow fear ring? Holy shit.
Dude, no spoilers, man. I thought with a name like Sinestro, he was going to be good for all 12 inevitable Green Lantern films.
Right.
But I didn't agree with the uniform they picked. It wasn't the true Sinestro uniform with the circus flails by the neck. Oh, come on, guys.
Man, I don't know if you're joking or not, because I do know that you're a big Green Lantern fan, but that kind of sounds like...
I'm not joking.
That sounds like how I got really disappointed when I heard that the first Spider-Man movie was coming out, and there were organic web shooters as opposed to the designed ones by Peter Parker, you know?
Well, you know who you can blame for that is James Cameron.
Yes, yeah.
That was in the original James Cameron treatment for that movie that he didn't end up directing, but yeah. That was still inspired. I was always fascinated to find that out.
Yeah.
King of the
also,
world.
The fact they look like tiny wrist vaginas. Good night!
Awesome. Man, that is...
I wanted to judge Tyler for being a Green Lantern nerd, but then I realized I started this podcast by bragging about getting retweeted by Star Wars, so I can't anybody.
It all comes around, young one.
It does come around. It does.
Oh, man. All right, well, speaking of going around, let's go around the circle and see... you like that? You like that, Tyler?
Very good. Very good. Someone's been reading there.
Let's go around the circle.
For dummies.
And just tell people where they can find more of our work on the internet this week. Tyler, let's start with you.
Well, you can find me in DC Pearson's All Gimp performance of Pulp Fiction.
Gimp Fiction?
You can find me at the Solar Sentinel, notjustnewmovies.com, Destageddon. I posted a new video, a nature walk video, on the Solar Sentinel, so be sure to check that out.
Good stuff. DC Pearson, where can people track you down this week?
I am at twitter.com DC Pearson, so follow me there for goofy puns, etc. Then I have a website, dcpearson.com, which is intermittently updated but has a lot of content like short stories and all kinds of fun stuff, and there's a lot of stuff there. And then my book is called The Boy Who Couldn't Sleep and Never Had To. That's in stores, and also it's on Kindle and on iBooks or eBooks or whatever the thing is for your iPad, so that's exciting. And then Mystery Team is streaming on Netflix.
Good stuff. Good stuff. And I should point out, for those of you who, for some reason, can't read the title where I write guest DC Pearson, his name is actually spelled P-I-E-R-S-O-N.
Yes, the traditional spelling as opposed to the renegade P-E-A Pearsons, who we do not associate ourselves with except via Skype.
Which would be mine, yes. So you guys can track me down on Twitter, twitter.com/BenPears, which is B-E-N-P-E-A-R-S. you can find me writing.
Funny every time.
GeekTyrant.com, Filmonic.com, NotJustNewMovies.com, the namesake for this podcast, and you can hear me also on the Geek Tyrant Weekly Podcast. Music for our show is provided by George Turner and the Bandits. You can find their music at GTBandits.com, and they're also on Twitter and Facebook, so check them out there. DC Pearson, thanks so much for stopping by and hanging out with us. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, you guys. This was a blast. I'll talk to you later.
Good stuff. All right, you guys, thanks for listening. We're going to be watching The Big Lebowski next week, so feel free to check that out, which is also available on Netflix Watch Instantly right now. Send us an email, leave us a voicemail, let us know what you think, and we'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
Later. Money that